bear with me a moment.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're on, Jeffrey. How are you? Good morning.
Jeff?
Well, it may not be Jeffrey. Hello, Jeffrey? Well, there is somebody on the line, but I don't know who it is. So, and he hasn't responded. So I guess today's broadcast is naturally going to be with Brendan Beery, who's already on the line, and Jeffrey Swartz, which we're hoping to hear eventually, and both from WMU Cooley Law School, and their opinions, whether they agree or disagree, has nothing to do with WMU Cooley Law School. Or their faculty or anybody else involved that way. So it's their personal opinion. So I hope I was succinct about that because it's all contemporaneous on my part. I've never done that before.
Right. Oh, apparently you were listening.
Hold on, maybe now it's yeah.
As they push the button
to some extent. Oh, okay,
push the button,
okay.
Ezzy.
How are you?
Push the button, Ezzy. I was there before.
Oh, you were?
I was there when you said I wasn't. No, stop. I was there when you said I wasn't there, and you said there was somebody there, but you don't know who it was. I was there.
Okay. Okay. Well, I didn't know it was you.
I did
press the button, but maybe it's the... Well, thank goodness for that.
You muted me. And it's okay. Thanks. I was there. I heard it go Blog Talk Radio.
See? Poor Hezzy. Jeff probably muted himself, and now he's trying to blame Hezzy for it.
I did not mute because I checked to see if I did that, and I didn't do that.
You pulled back because I must have messed up, so my apology, as you well know.
No, don't worry.
I'll be the first to say I'm sorry.
By the way,
yes.
I'm supposed to tell you we're not WMU Cooley Law School anymore.
Are you just Cooley Law School?
Cooley Law School. Just Cooley Law School.
Okay.
Take that WMU and
okay.
Get rid of it. Okay?
I will.
Good riddance.
I was thinking about that last night, and then I didn't realize, but I wasn't sure. I was a little bit confused.
Yeah,
so,
well.
For the future, I'll get it right.
I know. You got an email from Tyler. Okay? Tyler wouldn't lie to you.
Oh.
About that.
Okay. Well, you know, I didn't realize you sent me an email. Maybe I just haven't read it.
I'm about to get a text
Tyler
message
on?
From Tyler. Okay, no, he's not. He's
okay.
Going to send me a text message. It's okay. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
And now anybody who's listening has no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well,
so
Tyler
okay.
is the PR guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the PR guy. Yeah. He's the PR guy.
Yeah.
He's working on the rollout of our rebrand.
Well, I didn't know you needed rebranding. I thought you were doing
not
pretty
us.
Well.
School. Not us. It's
oh,
school.
Okay.
Although we could use some branding help too.
I got my chest is branded for the Yellowstone Ranch. So, it's okay. It's a joke if you watch Yellowstone. All the workers there get branded with a big Y on their chest.
Jeez.
Uh-huh.
So there you go. Okay.
Well,
another cultural reference goes right
can't
over my
afford
head.
A branding.
Yeah, it beats a tattoo. How's that? So,
all right.
It's more permanent than a tattoo. Okay. can we get on with what we're supposed to do here?
Yeah, what are we talking about?
I don't know. We can talk about whatever we want to talk about. Okay, I heard you start to give the did you finish the disclaimer?
I think I did, but I don't. It wasn't as lucid as yours. Mine was contemporaneous.
That's okay. Okay. I'm not lucid. Under any circumstances would anybody say I'm lucid. So, Okay. So, all right. I'm going to go with what you did for 1 week. I'm going to go with what you did. We'll see if I get any blowback from it. Okay. we have a lot to talk about this morning. and we're going to try to actually try to talk about it all. And so, we've been trying to think of something funny to talk about, but there ain't a whole lot of things funny out there these days.
No, there's not.
No, there's not. So we're going to start out with probably the most tragic of all the things we were going to talk about, and that is the recent upheaval that's taken place in the state of Texas. The state that I kind of wished would secede from the union and, you know, let them go off. Maybe they can take over. You know, they always wanted to take over Mexico anyway. So maybe they'll just take over Mexico. I'm sure that, you know, unless you live, you know, in a hole in the ground covered up by a rock, you've heard of what's going on in the state of Texas with a woman by the name of Kate Cox. Ms. Cox is a few months pregnant. She's starting to show. She's at 21 weeks. She has a child, a fetus, that has very severe malformations, including an extra chromosome that will cause the child essentially to, if it makes it to term, which is most of them don't, with what she has, if she did make it to term, her child would likely die either in childbirth itself or within a day or two afterwards at the most. Her doctors recommended, and she sought to have an abortion simply because she wants to have more children, and they have told her if she gives birth to this child, that it's likely she will never be able to have children again. She saw she went to court to get an injunction to stop the state of Texas from prosecuting her and for the protection of the doctors who wanted to perform this ceremony, or not this, I'm sorry, surgery. The state judge who heard the case in the trial court ruled in her favor and said that the emergency existed and that the conditions under the Texas statute existed and issued the injunction. Within hours, Ken Paxton, the criminal that he is, please sue me, Mr. Paxton. I'd love to prove the truth is an absolute defense. Mr. Paxton has been indicted. He is the Attorney General of the state of Texas. He's been indicted and managed to get off in federal court. He is still under investigation by federal authorities for all kinds of felonies. He was impeached 143-2 in the Texas House of Representatives. But his wife, who happens to be one of the state senators who couldn't vote, sat in the chamber as he stood trial in front of the state Senate and lobbied, I'm sure by threatening people, to get him acquitted in the state Senate. I'm sure words like, he's going to run again, he's going to win again, and he's coming after you if you vote against him. I'm sure those words slipped out of her mouth somewhere along the line. He knows better than the doctors. He knows better than the trial judge. He knows better than the woman herself. And she's not entitled to this. And courts have no business being involved until somebody gets charged with a crime. And he went to the Supreme Court of Texas. And guess what the Supreme Court of Texas did? They overturned the trial court, and they found, in fact, courts have no business granting permission or not. This is up for doctors to do. And if the doctors say she needs it and they're mistaken, well, they'll pay the price for it. They'll be charged. They'll lose their licenses. They'll be disciplined. You know, trying to threaten someone before they even make a decision that we're going to charge you. And so while the Texas Supreme Court was, and they issued a stay, by the way, so she couldn't even go in and have it done before they could rule, while they were writing their opinion, she left the state of Texas. And in the words of lawyers, in the words of her lawyers, people that work for the Center for Reproductive Rights, they said that she had left the state, but they wouldn't say where, but someplace where they, quote, offer to help her access abortion elsewhere from Kansas to Colorado to Canada.
Wow.
They don't know where she – they may know where she is, but her lawyers won't say where she is, and these people won't talk either. And I'm sure whatever she needs to do has been done by today.
Mm-hmm.
The understanding is that her husband stayed in Texas, so they can't charge him with aiding and abetting or conspiring. And when she comes back, I'm sure, because the Texas law – doesn't allow them to prosecute the woman, it's over and done. Now, they'll try. Paxton will charge conspiracy to commit murder, and he'll go after everybody and go after her for conspiracy, too, because he knows better. What this is about is men deciding they know better than anybody else, and women should do the following: be barefoot, cook dinner, and get pregnant. And that's all. And they should make lots and lots of white babies so we can battle the source of people of color making babies and us being outbirthed. That's what this is all about. It's about misogyny. And it's about white power, the white male power. Enough. And the great part about this is, if there is a silver lining around this dark cloud, is that women in the state of Texas should be literally, and I'll say it the right way, they got to be so pissed off right now that Republicans better watch out for the blue wave that's going to sweep all over Texas. Because they're going after them. And if I'm a Supreme Court justice in Texas and I'm up for re-election in 24, I would retire rather than face the ignominy of being removed. And Ken Paxton, well, I don't give you 2 cents for your political career. This is one of the meanest, terrible things I have seen in a long time. For that Supreme Court to say the following: no one disputes that Mrs. Cox's pregnancy has been extremely complicated. Any parents would be devastated to learn of their unborn fatal condition diagnosis. Some difficulties in pregnancy, however, even serious ones, do not pose the heightened risk to the mother the exception encompasses. The exception requires the doctor to decide whether Mrs. Cox's difficulties pose such risks. A doctor asked the court to pre-authorize the abortion, yet she could not, or at least did not, attest to the court that Ms. Cox's condition poses the risk exception requires. A separate case, and then there's a separate case still pending dealing with what a medical emergency is. They basically are saying, don't go to court. We aren't going to help you. Take your best shot. And if you're wrong, pay the price. And so we have spoken. And so it shall be. Just awful. So there. What do you got to say about that, Brendan?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, it's times like these you wish it was okay to start cursing and dropping F-bombs on Hezzy's show, but
mm-hmm.
I will not do that. You know, the specter of this, of a woman who wants to have more kids, as you said, who already has kids, who wants to have a big family, who wants to have this child, has been told, and I heard some more details this morning about the what would happen to this child, as you say, if the child made it to term. What this woman would have to do then, after this child was born, is hold the child in her arms and watch it suffocate. That's what is in store for this child. Under these circumstances, for the state of Texas to chase a woman out of the state in order to get medical services to which she obviously is entitled and which she obviously requires, how unseemly can we get? How primitive can we get? You use the word mean, and I would second that as well. How mean and nasty can we get? And all in the name of what? Supposedly a concern for life, pro-life. This is pro-cruelty and pro-death is what this is. And I agree with you, it's about misogyny and all that. But I also just wonder how much of it is just plain cruelty. Obviously all this was made possible by the Supreme Court's decision in that recent case called Dobbs, where the court upended 50 years of precedent. A couple things to make clear about that. Number one, the term abortion on demand is a political term that the right wing uses. The U.S. Supreme Court has never, ever said that any woman is constitutionally entitled to any abortion at any time during the pregnancy. In fact, states are allowed to regulate quite a bit as long as they didn't place what the courts used to call an undue burden on a woman wanting to end a pregnancy early in the pregnancy. Once a fetus was viable under the old rules that the Supreme Court had crafted, the state could go so far as to ban any kind of a post-viability abortion. It's up to states. They were allowed to do that. All the court had ever said was that there is an unlisted, right, unenumerated right in the Constitution that protects certain privacy interests. People might say, well, how can the Constitution protect a woman's right to choose to end a pregnancy if the Constitution doesn't say anything about abortion or pregnancy or anything like that? And this is pretty simple, actually. If anybody wants to study the Constitution a little bit, make sure you read up to that amendment, the Ninth Amendment. Make sure you don't skip that part. The Ninth Amendment says explicitly that just because the Constitution lists certain rights, that doesn't mean that there aren't others, quote unquote, retained by the people. So courts, you know, it's a cop-out to say, well, if the Constitution doesn't say anything about it, it can't be a constitutional right. The Constitution says there's such a thing as an unenumerated, unlisted constitutional right, and that obviously leaves it to courts to figure out what those are. When you look at the rights that are protected by the Constitution, freedom of speech, religion, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures of your person, your papers, your effects, your home. What courts have looked at in the past is that, you know, that's privacy stuff. There are places where the government does not belong. It doesn't belong in my head. My thoughts, my beliefs are my own. My religion, right? That's not the government's business. My home, my papers, my effects, my body, not the government's business. And that's why courts have said that governments shouldn't be in Ms. Cox's business, right? That's why the Supreme Court used to say, right, that under these circumstances, there's no question that she would have a right to terminate a pregnancy without the state of Texas getting in her business. That's all the stuff is about. It's not about pro-abortion. That's another, you know, I mean, who's pro-abortion? Give me a break. This is all made-up poppycock. Nobody's pro-abortion. The question isn't whether I want Ms. Cox to have an abortion. The question is whether it's up to me. And that's something Republicans can't seem to get straight. If you're for limited government, then for crying out loud, start getting serious about it. It's not up to you to decide what parents teach their kids about sexual identity or gender identity. It's not up to you to tell your kids what they can read in school. It's not up to you to tell women what they can do with their reproductive health. It's not up to you to tell gay people what kind of relationships they can have. Get out of it. Get out of people's business.
All I can tell you, it boggles the mind that these are the same people who are in favor of the death penalty. In both instances, right. They quote the Bible. They quote the Bible inaccurately. And in the case of the death penalty, for example, they say an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And that may be, but that's God's right. If you read it properly, God says, I take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's how I punish. That's how God says he punishes. That's not how man is supposed to punish. So don't rely on the Bible or anything in it to justify the things you're doing. Do I still have the right to kill my wife because she fails to cover her head? Bible says I can. And if the Bible is the law, then I can't be charged with murder, can I? I don't want to hear Bible, 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 Bible. We don't live in those days anymore. That religion is a matter of faith, not reliance upon the truth of a word written in a book centuries after the person or millennia after the person who supposedly experienced all of this. The Jewish Bible are the five books of Moses. Moses died long before they were ever written. The New Testament is filled with Gospels written centuries after Jesus died. There may be some truth in it as to sequence of events, but even some of the events are not accurate. But you believe in it as a matter of faith. Your faith does not have to be my faith. So I don't want to hear that. And people like Ken Paxton don't care about the religious. They spout it, but they don't believe it. Because if I recall correctly, thou shalt not steal is one of the Ten Commandments, and Ken Paxton doesn't understand or believe in that commandment. He's got no right to speak holier than thou. He just wants to subjugate women, even though his wife is a state senator. She's allowed. I'm sorry, we don't live in caves anymore, and you're not a hunter-gatherer. We recognize women as people, people with the same rights as anybody else. Stay out of their business. Republicans, you're going to pay the price for this again and again and again till you start realizing you're wrong. And I will tell you now, I appreciate that you keep wanting to be wrong about everything. Should we move on to another subject?
It's so true, though. It's like, take any issue you want to take, and they're on the wrong side of it. It's like it's intentional, you know?
I mean, if they're such believers in polls, then why don't they look at the polls that tell them they're wrong about guns, they're wrong about abortion, they're wrong about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. They're wrong about all these things. The people don't want what they're selling. All they sell is fear. And Ozzie and Harriet.
My question is there a mechanism for women really to revolt against all of this, or do they have something to vote for?
Yes.
Or is it the candidate that they...
It all depends on where you are. They've proven what they will vote for. They proved it in Kansas. They proved it in Ohio. They're about to prove it in Florida. Okay, they can prove it. They have a mechanism. But
men are not listening.
They can approve candidates.
Mm. Yeah.
They can approve candidates, and candidates are the way to get it done. Let them go into the legislatures or Congress and do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, if the Equal Rights Amendment passed, they'd really have a problem.
Yeah.
But that's dead meat already. They're not going to extend the time for ratification again, so that one's over.
Yeah, and, you know, to a large extent, and this is the frustrating part about trying to get people to pay attention. To a large extent, this question was on the ballot in 2016. And you just couldn't get people to listen. You know, anybody, I've said this before, anybody who is appalled that the Supreme Court issued the Dobbs decision that has led to all this, and who also stayed home in 2016 because of Hillary's emails, you don't have standing to complain. You're the reason this happened. Presidents pick federal judges, including justices of the Supreme Court. And so when Americans intentionally put Donald Trump in the Oval Office, there was no question when he ran that he was running to overrule Roe. And there was no question when you look at the age of the justices, right, when he ran and Hillary ran, that the outcome of that election would determine the future of the Supreme Court for a generation. And so to your question, Hezzy, is there anything that can be done at this point? Well, what needed to be done in 2016.
Yeah.
And to a large extent, the answer to your question is no. How long it's going to take to change the course of the Supreme Court, we're talking decades. And so people just need to start understanding that elections have consequences. If I hear one more time, it doesn't matter who wins. All politicians are the same. It doesn't affect my life. You know, they're all out to screw me and collect my taxes. Just shut up.
Tell me how you really think.
Come on.
Shut up. You're telling people to shut up. That's about as harsh as I've ever heard you talk.
Those people. Okay. I don't want to hear that again, right? Elections don't have consequences. Okay, if you're saying that, then yeah, come on. Get over yourself.
Really? Moving on. I want to get to this, so we're going to do this first. Jack Smith, I don't want to miss this. I mean, the other stuff we can deal with, but I don't want to miss this.
Yeah.
Okay? Mr. Smith has gone to Washington, and he's shaking things up, as all Mr. Smiths do when they go to Washington. And he's doing things a little bit differently. As you're all aware, the former guy, you know, the one with the spray can and the twisted hair, he decided that I have immunity from prosecution for anything I do while I'm in office. Be it criminal or not, I'm immune from prosecution after I leave office. Okay? I have disputed, based upon a real precedent, that he's not immune from being prosecuted while he's in office. It seems to be something that we've sort of accepted as being a policy, but it's not constitutional.
Mm. Right.
And I point to just one person, the most effete snob of all effete snobs. And I say that only because those were his two favorite words. And that's Spiro Agnew. Who is Spiro Agnew? Well, that's because you don't remember vice presidents. He was Richard Nixon's vice president. Mm-hmm. Richard Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, had done some really terrible things before he took office when he was the governor of Maryland. And he was investigated by the Department of Justice. He thought it was appropriate to investigate an Article II elected executive. And Article II makes really, other than their duties, no exception between the president and the vice president. They come to office the same way. They serve the same term. They have the same oath. And he was indicted for all those terrible things while he was in office. He pled guilty, and he was still vice president. The plea deal said that after he pled guilty and was sentenced, then he would have to resign, which he did. So I don't want to hear that an Article II of the United States Constitution, in case you're wondering what I'm talking about, Article II does not grant anyone immunity that I can see. And I got a constitutional expert that's on the phone here with me, and I assume that he agrees with me, or he would interrupt me and tell me, that's not quite accurate, Jeff. Okay? Okay. So the truth of the matter is that I don't see it in the Constitution. It was a policy decision. It was not a constitutional decision. Now, the reason why I bring that up is because we should have indicted Richard Nixon, and we didn't. I blame Jerry Ford for where we are today. There is no person on the face of the earth more responsible for where we are today as far as the legal system is concerned than Jerry Ford. He pardoned Richard Nixon. Some of you may not remember he was a president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so Richard Nixon is being charged, before he resigned, was involved in the Watergate scandal. And they were seeking information from Richard Nixon. They wanted the tapes of his conversations. And it was winding its way through the system, and Jaworski, who was the special prosecutor at that point, went to the Supreme Court and asked the Supreme Court, I don't want to wait. I don't want to wait for a district court. I don't want to wait for a circuit court because this will take forever. I want you, Supreme Court, to take this right now. I want you to take certiorari. Take jurisdiction. You'll find, by the way, for those of you who like to read, you'll find the decision at 417 U.S. 927. United States versus Nixon. And they took CERT. But they did more than that. And we'll talk about the grounds for CERT in a minute. In addition to filing a request with the Supreme Court to take the issues, which I will describe shortly, now, not later, but now, he also filed a motion for an expedited briefing schedule. And taking the framework of what the United States Supreme Court decided in the United States versus Nixon, he said, consistent with the circumstances of this case, the parties would exchange and file opening briefs 14 days after the granting of cert, and any responsive brief would be due 7 days thereafter. Not even giving time for a rebuttal brief with oral argument to be held as soon as practicable. If the court wants to take amicus briefs, that's, you know, friend of the court briefs, supporting the parties, they would be due on the date of the parties' briefs are due. In other words, they don't get to read what everybody else writes. He wants this done. He literally wants this done by the end of the year, almost. He wants oral argument the first or second week of January. He wants a decision within a week or two after that, and he wants nothing stayed. He wants everybody to keep working towards the March 14th or whatever date it is, trial date. He wants this over. So much for the stall. March 4th is the date they're supposed to start picking a jury. He wants to keep going. And he's right. Now, what is this all about? In his petition for cert, Jack Smith says a lot. It's not a long petition. It's about 10 pages long. The fundamental question, and it's at the heart of our democracy, is whether a former president is absolutely immune from federal prosecution for crimes committed while in office or is constitutionally protected from federal prosecution when he has been impeached but not convicted. The second part of the former guy's argument is that, hey, I already stood trial, and the Senate acquitted me. That's not a criminal prosecution. It has no criminal – the answer is simple. Even a moron like me can tell you that jeopardy hasn't attached. You're laughing. I can hear you. Jeopardy.
I am. I have to. Really.
Okay. Jeopardy attaches two ways. When the jury's sworn, not when they swear to tell the truth in selection, but when they are sworn to well and truly try the case, they are the jury, or when the first witness is sworn to testify in a non-jury trial. None of those things happen in front of the United States Senate. Jeopardy deals with the issues of being at risk of life or limb. There is no life or limb in front of the Senate. This is an administrative or congressional proceeding. Nobody goes to jail. You just lose your ability to run for office, maybe. Or you get thrown out of the office that you're in. I.e., my friend Elsie Hastings, God rest his soul, is impeached and removed as a federal judge. But guess what? He became a congressman and served for like 25 years. He didn't go to jail. Removal is the penalty. Yeah, throw that one aside. I have no idea what kind of constitutional moron was doing the briefs or making the arguments on this one. I just would have loved to have been the judge to look at him and say, really? Can you cite some authority for that one? No? That's because it's a ridiculous thought. Let's move on to the other one. But the idea that a president of the United States can violate any law he wants, that's Richard Nixon. What I'm saying is when the president does it, it's not illegal. What? So in other words, Trump is right. He can stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and there's nothing you can do to him because he's a president of the United States. Not so. In fact, Ronald Reagan, had he not been suffering from Alzheimer's, might have been indicted to go with the other people who were for Iran-Contra. I have no doubts about that. This immunity thing goes nowhere. It's like saying you can try to overthrow the government and you could call in the army and have people killed, but you're not responsible and you cannot be convicted of that. You cannot be tried for your acts against the government. Only in the case of treason, which is not defined as insurrection, because we weren't at war with anybody, or bribery. According to what he's arguing, those are the only two things that a president can be charged with while he's for an act he did in office. That's just horse manure, horse hockey, as Sherman Potter used to call it, horse hockey. Okay? And he and Jack Smith says that. He says, you have to decide this. Because you're going to decide it, so decide it now. Donald is plotting right now. His lawyers don't know what to do. I don't want the Supreme Court. No, I want a Stallmore, so I want the circuit to decide and then come to you. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to decide eventually, but let the circuit do it first. You might agree with them. They might. But I'd rather they agreed with him now than later. I just don't get it. I do not get it. Tell me where any of this makes sense to you, oh constitutional expert.
No, it was a good move on the part of Jack Smith. Because this is what we call a pure question of law, right? There are no facts in dispute, mm-hmm. as to this issue. And you don't need a trial court or an intermediate appellate court to tackle this stuff when it's just purely a legal question that any judge can answer probably in 5 minutes. It is going to wind up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's no question about it. I was happy to see that they've already issued an order requiring Trump's lawyers to respond by the 20th of this month. So they're already signaling that they're going to expedite this. As to the merits, there was a recent opinion by a district judge who said two things that are worth bearing in mind. In one devastating sentence. And what she wrote was, the president is not a king, and Donald Trump is not the president.
Right.
Those are two very key points. In a case also involving Donald Trump, but against Cyrus Vance, the prosecutor in New York at the time, the Supreme Court already said that the president is not immune from criminal process. Now, that at that point, we weren't at the point of indictment or anything like that, so they didn't go beyond what they needed to. But Donald Trump was claiming at the time that he couldn't even be investigated in a criminal case. or served with papers in a criminal case.
And he was actually still in office at the time.
Right. Yes, right. Yep, and even then, the Supreme Court said no. I mean, you have the same protections afforded to you in a criminal proceeding as anybody else. You can, you can appeal to the trial court to protect you from prosecutorial overreach, just like anybody else. But you don't get special treatment. So they, this court has signaled where it's headed here, and you know,
I think they're working on the. I think they're working on the opinion already. How do you like that?
Yeah, yeah. I would be, it's and in case anybody else, yeah, for sure. People might also want to. I'm not going to be as fancy as Jeff here and give you a citation to it, but it's called Clinton versus Jones. Anybody can Google that, right? Where the court said in that case. Now that was a civil case, but still, the court said, for conduct undertaken by a president, either when the president is not president, right, or in any matter that's completely unrelated to the president's duties as president, the president's not immune. That was, of course, Bill Clinton being sued at the time, and the court saying, no, you're not immune from the suit.
And if you don't believe Brendan, just go to 520 U.S. 681.
There you go. Thanks for backing me up on that. Yeah.
But I believe Brendan. I never even questioned it.
Oh, God. That's this is pretty clear where the court's going on that. That's the first point part of that quote, right? The president's not a king, right? That's where the court's going to go with that. And Donald Trump is not the president. I mean, even the memo that you're talking about that the Department of Justice wrote about why it wouldn't prosecute a sitting president, right? That's an OMB memorandum from inside the Department of Justice. As you said, not a constitutional decision at all, a policy decision. All the reasoning in that memo is that the president's the president. There are a lot of logistical problems involved in bringing a criminal prosecution, which of course would include possible detainment and all of that. Somebody who's supposed to be executing the office of president of the United States at the time. Well, all those arguments go out the window for Donald Trump here because he's not the president. Again, that one devastating sentence, right? Presidents aren't kings, and Donald Trump is not the president. Okay, that solves this case right there in one sentence.
Right. Yeah, it just amazes me that this is even a question. It amazes me that any lawyer, this is almost a spurious action.
Yeah.
Okay, I think the motion is spurious. It has no merit whatsoever. But I'm talking about the motion that Donald's lawyers filed in front of Chunkin. Okay. As far as I'm concerned, again, maybe I'm just a hard ass, but I would look down and say, counsel, can you cite any authority for what you're arguing? No? Well, I got a bunch here that says you're wrong. Not right on point, but it tells me you're wrong. And I think you've read these, and I think you know better. So I'm going to deny your motion as spurious. Lots of luck with that one now. There, any lawyer worth his salt knows better. They just know better. They're taught better than that. And to me, it's nothing more than a stall technique that no court should sanction and no court should agree with and no court should grant and no court should give any extensions for it. You're going to trial on March 4th. Get over yourself and don't come in because all the work you did up until this point has delayed your preparation for trial. You're from a big firm. You got lots of people working for you. Not going to buy it. And she's holding their feet to the fire and they don't like it because they know by the middle of April, middle to end of April, he is going to be a convicted felon. A convicted felon that she can declare is ineligible to run for president of the United States. He'll be ineligible to run anyway. Because New York requires that you be a registered voter to be able to run. Most states do. He won't qualify in most states because he's not a registered voter anywhere. He's a registered voter in Florida right now. If he's convicted, he loses his civil rights. He can't qualify to run and be on a ballot. We don't have to worry about the 14th Amendment. He's out of the box, but I think she'll find he's ineligible under the 14th Amendment anyway. I think when she accepts the verdict and adjudicates him guilty of the felonies, I think she's going to find him ineligible to run. Sua sponte. And he's going to be done. Jack Smith has also been busy otherwise, hasn't he, Brendan?
Yep.
What else
do you do?
I've got it in front of me, and I'll read it verbatim, but why don't you tell everybody what it is they're going to hear?
Yeah, he's another filing in the same case in front of Judge Chutkan has identified three expert witnesses he intends to call at trial. And since you got it in front of you, I'm going to punt over to you, Jeff, to talk about, in particular, what the third witness he identified. Sounds like they've got some interesting material to discuss.
Okay. But it's the third expert who promises to introduce the most potentially explosive evidence. That's a quote from his filing, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Expert three has knowledge, skill, experience, training, and education beyond the ordinary layperson regarding the analysis of cellular phone data, including the use of Twitter, now known as X, and other applications on cell phones. The government expects that expert three will testify as follows. One, extracted and processed data from the White House cell phones used by the defendant and one other individual, the person known as Individual One in the indictment, who I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe is Mark Meadows. Two, reviewed and analyzed data on the defendant's, and by the way, they've got Meadows' phone. We know he's cooperated and turned over his phone. Two, reviewed and analyzed data on the defendant's phone and on Individual One's phone, including analyzing images found on the phones and websites visited. Three, determined the usage of those phones throughout the post-election period, including on or around January 6, 2021. And four, specifically identified the periods of time during which the defendant's phone was unlocked and the Twitter application was open on January 6th. In other words, who was he communicating? Because they said that he was communicating through Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Private messages were being sent by Trump to other people by way of private messages on Twitter. They want to know who he was talking to. I think they know. Well, they know. They just want someone to explain how they know.
Mm-hmm.
They know who he was talking to. Jim Jordan, are you hearing me? Enrique, can you hear me? Who he was communicating with? Steve Bannon, can you hear me? Rudy Giuliani, can you hear me? The people he was communicating with. Ted Cruz, can you hear me? Josh Hawley, can you hear me? Your names are going to be heard communicating in a conspiracy for insurrection. You're next. Once they convict Trump, he's going to sing like a bird and throw you all under the bus to try to save his own hide. Loyalty only goes one way with this guy, and it ain't in your direction. They got him. They got him every which way from Sunday. And anybody believes that he's actually going to walk out of that courtroom is living in another world. That last day when they announce the verdicts will be the last day he walks out of that courthouse, because he ain't leaving. He'll be going on a bus. I think this is Jack Smith is so much better than Trump's lawyers, you have no idea. Because Trump doesn't even have the kind of lawyers that he can afford to buy, because none of them want to work for him. Mm-hmm. He's playing with the second string. And if he keeps going, he's going to be playing with the practice squad. He hasn't got the first stringers that he needs. Anybody who believes that Kais is a first stringer doesn't live, it must be outside the state of Florida, because we know what a minuscule player he is. He's a political hack. He's not a good lawyer. He's a political hack. Even in New York right now, he has second stringers representing him. He couldn't even find a good New York lawyer to represent him. That'll be his next action. I had ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
You know that's where he's going to go. You think I'm wrong?
No. All right.
Can you see the 2255 motion now?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, my God. They did this and they did that and they gave me bad advice. I think it's more likely you gave yourself. You look in the mirror, pal. There's your ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Go ahead. Say something.
Well, we only got 2 minutes left. You wanna end with Hunter, the Joe Biden's crime of having a screwed up kid?
Yeah. Go back to the $1,000 a month bribery scheme.
Yeah, right.
You know, I feel kind of bad for him, because the truth of the matter is that once you pay the amount of tax that he owed, there's no question he's guilty of, and his own lawyer said this, yeah, he's guilty of evading taxes.
Mm-hmm.
He's guilty of not paying. But he paid. And the penalties were the penalty for the late payment. And the interest on the penalty and the interest on the tax, he paid over $2 million. And that was 2 years ago. A guy like him usually is not indicted. They're just not. Or they get misdemeanor tax evasion charges. They don't get indicted for multiple felonies. And there's nothing new. Abby Lowe said this the other day on television. He said basically that the prosecutor in this case, the special prosecutor, the special counsel, knew all of this when he entered into the prior plea agreement. It was contemplated in the prior plea agreement. He knew all of it. He didn't learn anything new after they set that plea agreement aside and he indicted him on the gun charges, he didn't learn anything new. This is the same stuff that they knew all along. What changed? That's a question, Brendan. What changed?
Yeah. Republican blowback.
There you go. Nothing changed. There were no facts that changed. None of the circumstances of Hunter Biden's addiction, nothing changed. There were no new taxes. They'd all been paid, but they had to come up with something because, you know, the Biden crime family has to be indicted for something.
Mm-hmm.
The Biden crime family. Seriously.
This from defenders of Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
the world is upside
really,
down.
When you know, if they want to find a crime family, why don't you just go visit your Lord and Savior, Donald Trump? There is a crime family. Whoa. Headed up by the Don himself. Don Donald. One of these days, he's going to have to close up that overcoat. And he's going to look like a penguin. Okay. I don't know why he has buttons on his suit coat. I mean, seriously. I'm sorry. I'm getting off. I'm really getting way far afield here. So, be that as it may.
Yeah.
Okay. We had a bunch of other stuff we were going to talk about, which we will get to next week, I promise. There's a very interesting case called Brian Tingley versus the Attorney General of the State of Washington involving conversion therapy for people who are transgender. And it comes from the Ninth Circuit, so you can imagine how the Ninth Circuit would have ruled. The Supreme Court refused to accept cert on that one, and we'll talk about why, because I love the opinion of Justice Thomas, who argues it's a free speech issue. And a nice lady who was 83 years old when a traffic stop got handcuffed and put on her knees. And the Harvard president, Claudine Gay. The breaking news is that the board of directors of the Harvard Corporation has decided Ms. Gay gets to keep her job, even though they're losing tons and tons of Jewish money. I guess they'll make up for it with money that they get from Saudi Arabia. They already get more Saudi Arabian money than any other money right now. So she gets to keep her job. That'll remain a controversy. The Crimson will go after her. That's the newspaper for the students, the student newspaper, which, by the way, is better than most newspapers in the United States. So we'll talk about things like that. I'm still hot after Ms. Kay. I just don't think she belongs where she is. But they didn't ask me, so I didn't get to voice my opinion. What else?
Indeed.
Anything else we can talk about before we get off the air here? Because I was late.
No, I think we're.
I was excluded from the first 3 minutes. You got anything?
Yeah. Nope. It's 11:04. It's Hezzy's air.
Okay. Anything you don't know? Nothing for the good of the order. Okay.
No.
Hezzy,
no.
We thank you again as usual, for the hour of your time.
My pleasure.
And the pleasure of your company.
Thank you very, very much to both of you.
Thanks, Ezzy. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Goodbye, everybody.
All right. It'll be a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Enjoy. Thank you.
Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
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 All right. Let's move on to some other things, and we'll try to catch up with some other stuff. Bear with me a moment here. I lost my place somehow. One second here. Where are we? Almost there, I think. All right, let me just quickly check and see if something went wrong here. I don't know if it did or it didn't. Let's cover some things. Are we here? One moment. I'm sorry. Somehow or another, something went wrong with the system. Okay. Let's cover the latest stuff. Evidently, the United States has vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution demanding humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Well, the United States today vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution that would have called for an immediate ceasefire in the intense fighting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. The United States Deputy Representative at the United Nations, Robert Wood is his name, said that the resolution was, quote, divorced from reality, end quote, and, quote, would have not moved the needle forward on the ground, end quote. So that was the situation there. So the United States today vetoed a United Nations resolution that would have called for an immediate ceasefire in the intense fighting between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres had invoked Article 99 of the United Nations Charter to urge the organization's most powerful body to call for a ceasefire. Well, heavy urban combat raged in and around Gaza's biggest cities on Friday, with major battles reported in Jabalia, a refugee camp in the north, and Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Israel and the United Nations signaled that the Kerem Shalom crossing from Israel into the Gaza Strip might be opened soon to allow aid in. And since the start of the war, the tightly controlled Rafah border between Gaza and Egypt has been the only point of entry into the enclave. Well, Hamas attacked southern Israeli communities on October 7, killing 1,200 people, taking about 240 hostages, according to the Israeli government. And since then, at least 17,487 people have been killed in Israel's ensuing assault on the Gaza Strip, the territory's Hamas-run health ministry had said, and at least 46,000 people have been injured, and at least 7,600 people are missing, the Hamas media office had said. So the U.S. Has vetoed, oh, well, we told you about that. That was a few days ago. Bear with me a moment here. One second. All right, let me just move on to some other issues. Bear with me a moment. Let me just see if I can get this here. Yeah, evidently the fighting is raging across Gaza as the Israel-Hamas war enters its third month. Didn't realize it was that long. Heavy urban combat raged throughout Gaza today, with some of the war's most intensive fighting, and so far, and so that just continues. Heavy urban combat raged in and around Gaza. So it goes. Okay, bear with me a moment here. One moment. All right, let me just see if I can get to all my places. Well, here's the latest update with regard to Zelensky. He's going to visit Biden. So it seems that Ukraine's president is set to visit the United States counterpart, his U.S. counterpart, in a bid to push the U.S. Congress to free military aid for Kyiv. So we'll see how that goes. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is due to visit the United States President Joe Biden at the White House today, with both leaders hoping to find a way to release new U.S. military aid to Kyiv amid a deadlock in the U.S. Congress. The invitation by Biden was, quote, to underscore the United States' unshakable commitment to supporting the people of Ukraine as they defend themselves against Russia's brutal invasion, the White House announced in advance. Well, fresh U.S. aid to Ukraine is currently being blocked because of a domestic political row between Democrats and Republicans, some of whom are increasingly voicing doubts about the wisdom of continuing aid to Kyiv. According to Washington, the funds that have so far been approved for Ukraine will be completely exhausted by the end of the year. In good news for Kyiv on the international aid, however, the International Monetary Fund says it has approved another $900 million alone to Ukraine for budget support. Zelensky met with U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill. This is written about an hour ago. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, on the second day of his trip to Washington, met with U.S. lawmakers on Capitol Hill to make a last-ditch plea for continued military support in his fight against Russia. Wearing a black shirt and olive drab pants, Zelensky was greeted with sustained applause as he arrived for a closed-door meeting with U.S. senators. He was accompanied by Chuck Schumer, the chamber's top Democrat, and Mitch McConnell, the top Republican. Zelensky will also meet privately with House Speaker Mike Johnson and then head to the White House, where he and President Joe Biden will hold a news conference at about 4:15 local time. Well, the White House told Congress on December 4 that the administration will run out of money to provide more weapons to Ukraine after the end of the year. Congress has approved more than $110 billion for Ukraine since Russia's February 2022 invasion, but no new money has been approved since Republicans took over the House of Representatives from Democrats in January. The European Union must convince Hungary over Ukraine aid, German officials are saying. The European Union aims to convince Hungary to back its proposed $54 billion aid facility for Kyiv at its summit this week to send a clear signal to Russia, a German government official said. All but one of the bloc's 27 states support the Ukraine facility, the official had said, referring to Hungary, whose Prime Minister Viktor Orban has touted his ties with Moscow and threatened to veto the aid. Quote, our clear aim is to convince this state that the Ukraine facility is the right instrument to show our unity and send Russia a clear signal, but also to support U.S. President Joe Biden's effort to mobilize the further necessary support, the official had said. Ukraine needs planning stability as it enters its second wintertime fighting off a Russian invasion, an official told a briefing in Berlin, saying payouts from the shared European Union budget need unanimous support of all member states. Now, the German government officials also said that the budget crisis in Berlin, in the wake of a constitutional court decision that threw Germany's finances into disarray, would not affect the German government's commitment to providing aid to Ukraine. Well, the Ukraine facility is the highest priority in our point of view and must be financed come what may, the official said, noting that budget talks were not expected to prevent Chancellor Olaf Scholz from attending the summit. Well, hackers have paralyzed Ukraine's largest phone, mobile phone operator. Ukraine's largest mobile operator, Kyivstar, has been crippled by an unprecedented cyber attack. telephone and internet connections in the provider's network failed across the whole country. The company website was also unavailable. However, the company assured customers that personal data had not fallen into the wrong hands. Kyivstar says it had 24 million or has 24 million subscribers. The company recommended the subscribers switch to the networks of other providers. The origin of the hackers was initially unknown. Ukraine's SBU Security Service said it had opened a criminal investigation and sent agents to the company's offices. The special services of the Russian Federation may be behind this hacker attack, the SBU said in a statement. Quote, this is a war. It takes place not only on the battlefield, it also takes place in virtual space, and unfortunately, we are affected as a result of this war, Kyivstar's General Secretary Oleksandr Komarov said on national television. Quote, this is a war. It takes place not only in the battlefield, it also takes place in virtual space, and unfortunately, we are affected as a result of this war, Kyivstar's General Director Oleksandr Komarov said on national television. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian internet bank Monobank also reportedly became the target of a massive DDoS attack on Tuesday, and the country's second largest mobile phone provider, Vodafone, reported technical problems as well. Well, Finland is going to reopen parts of its border with Russia. Finland's government said on that it will reopen two crossings, Valima and Niirala, on its long border with Russia on Thursday after closing all 8 roads between the two countries in late November to prevent an influx of asylum seekers. The government has today decided to keep the eastern border closed except for the two border crossing points. Prime Minister Petteri Orpo. Now, Orpo said that the restrictions have been eased in order to assess whether, quote, there is a change for the better, end quote. Quote, further, he said, if the phenomenon continues, we will close these border crossings. Finland last month shut the Russian border until December 13 to block an increasing number of refugees from arriving in the Nordic nation to what the government and its allies said was an orchestrated move by Moscow. Some 900 asylum seekers from nations including Kenya, Morocco, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen entered Finland via Russia in November, and an increase from less than one per day previously. According to the Finnish border guard, the arrival stopped when Finland shut the border. Finland's relations with Moscow, with Russia, soured after the invasion of Ukraine. Moscow warned of countermeasures, quote-unquote, after Finland joined NATO in April, reversing its decades-long policy of military non-alignment. Well, detained U.S. Russian reporter faces new charges, said the RFE, Radio Free Europe, Liberty, said that the Russian authorities have leveled a fresh charge against its journalist, Alsu Kulmasheva. A U.S.-Russian dual citizen, Kulmasheva, was arrested in October in the central city of Kazan and charged with failing to register as a, quote, foreign agent, end quote. RFERL is funded by the U.S. government. Kulmasheva is now also accused of distributing fake, quote-unquote, news about Russia's armed forces, a charge that carries years in prison. The Baza Telegram account, with close links to law enforcement, said that the new charges were brought against her for a book titled Saying No to War, end quote, that she edited. The new charge against Kulmasheva is part of the legislation adopted by Moscow to stifle dissent in the wake of its war against Ukraine. Kulmasheva is the second U.S. journalist to be arrested in Russia this year. Evan Kershkovich, a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Moscow, has been in custody since March on spy charges he firmly denies. Well, Poland's Tusk is helping Ukraine says, in the interest of the free world. Newly appointed Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk on Tuesday said his government would try to maintain global support for Ukraine in its fight against Russian aggression. Quote, we will loudly and decisively demand the full mobilization of the free world, the Western world, to help Ukraine in the war, Tusk had said. In his policy speech to Parliament a day after his appointment, he said he found it painful that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had to make such efforts to persuade world leaders to keep up their assistance. Tusk also pledged to resolve the month-long blockade at the Ukraine border by Polish truckers who are calling for the reintroduction of entry permits for their Ukrainian competitors. Some have alleged that the blockade has hindered the transport of arms destined to help Ukrainian armed forces. Tusk, who was previously prime minister from 2007 to 2014, has returned to office at the head of an alliance that spans the political spectrum from left-wing to more conservative parties. He also served as European Council president from 2014 to 2019 and is expected to greatly improve Poland's relations with the European Union after many years of rule of law disputes between Warsaw and Brussels. Well, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is authorizing further funds to Kyiv. On Monday, the International Monetary Fund allowed Ukraine access to another loan tranche to the tune of about $900 million. The IMF Executive Board, which released the money after a second review of its loan program for Ukraine, said it was to be used for budget support. The arrangement under the extended fund facility is meant to bolster Ukraine's economic and financial stability, restore debt sustainability, and support Kyiv's path to European Union accession. In all, Ukraine will receive $15.6 billion through the fund. Quote, this program has been vital to maintain macroeconomic and financial stability and support the ongoing recovery, said IMF Chief Kristalina Georgieva after a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington. Quote, with the much-needed support from the international community, Ukraine has been able to implement and sustain strong economic policies, end quote, said Georgieva. Quote, the authorities also continue to demonstrate Ukraine's commitment to tackling vital governance and corruption issues, end quote. Zelensky said the IMF support was, quote, very important for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people, end quote. Further, he said, in times of war, a secure financial system is crucial, end quote. Well, Zelensky is going to visit Biden amid an aid impasse. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is due to visit U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House today as a domestic political dispute between Democrats and Republicans in Congress halts further billions in U.S. Military aid to Kyiv. Washington has said the funds that have so far been approved for Ukraine will completely run out by the end of the year. The two leaders will be hoping to find ways of persuading Congress to approve the aid package before the year and holidays. The funds in question are a $110 billion national security package, $61.4 billion of which would go toward Ukraine. A White House statement released in advance of the visit said that the leaders are expected to discuss, quote, Ukraine's urgent needs and the vital importance of the United States' continued support at this critical moment. During his visit, Zelensky also plans to meet with the members of Congress, including Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, in a bid to break the deadlock. Many Republican lawmakers have been calling on the government to focus more on domestic affairs instead of war in Europe. Moscow has responded to news of the impending meeting between Biden and Zelensky by saying that, quote, tens of billions of dollars, end quote, already given by the United States to Ukraine had failed to bring Kyiv battlefield success and that further aid would change nothing. All the same, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that Moscow would watch the meeting very attentively, quote unquote. Let's look at what's happening in the Congo. Congo's election campaign is eclipsed by unresolved conflict. The violent conflict in eastern Congo has dominated electoral campaigns ahead of the December 20 elections. The hurdles to holding free and fair elections in the vast Democratic Republic of the Congo are high. This bureaucratic act would require a long lead time, even under ideal conditions. But the conditions for the December 20 elections are far from ideal. A landmass of more than 2.3 million square kilometers, about 905,355 square miles, can only be covered by plane, and the roads are often in poor conditions. Everything takes longer, from registering voters to distributing election documents and ballot boxes. Yet, in an interview with Deutsche Welle, Congo's Independent National Electoral Commission, or CENI, is optimistic ahead of the presidential, parliamentary, and municipal polling. If God wills it, everything will be peaceful, said Didi Manara Linga, CENI's deputy chair, in a recent interview. Quote, after all the presidential candidates are holding their campaigns. So far, we haven't seen any obstacle that would be so big that we couldn't hold the election. Well, the focus is on eastern Congo. Currently, Congo's conflict-torn eastern provinces, especially North Kivu, have the full attention of politicians. Several presidential candidates have hit the campaign trail in eastern Congo, holding rallies in towns like Goma, Beni, and Butembo. It seems that the flare in the conflict that has pitted M23 rebels against pro-government local militias and Congolese soldiers has become the sole campaign issue. Presidential candidate Moise Katumbi, seen as a serious contender, has promised to bring peace to the East in 6 months. Nobel Peace Prize winner Denise Mukwege, also running for the presidency, sees peace in the East at the top, quote unquote, wrote Mukwege on X, formerly Twitter, after his appearance in Beni and Goma. Lobi te lelo, not tomorrow, but today. The M23 rebel group, which the United Nations has said is supported by neighboring Rwanda, de facto controls the territories of the Masisi and Rutshuru in North Kivu. As a result, voting won't take place there. Incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi has justified this exclusion of approximately 1 million eligible voters in the territories with the need to be able to hold the elections on schedule. The candidates' focus on North Kivu, M23, and Rwanda is, quote, quite contradictory, end quote, political analyst Onesphore Sematumba of the International Crisis Group, a think tank, advised. Well, quote, two territories are excluded from the electoral process because of the insecurity and presence of the M23, said Sematumba. But it is precisely these territories that are absent from the vote that are most present in the debate. Everything else, campaign programs and policies, has been forgotten, he pointed out. Sematumba criticized the fact that although Tshisekedi has been in power for 5 years, analysis of his presidency is lacking. Well, there is no significant reforms from Tshisekedi. During his 5 years in office, Tshisekedi has failed to end the raging conflict, which involves more than 120 rebel groups, despite numerous attempts to organize external support. Two international peacekeeping forces are withdrawing from the eastern Congo. The 15,000-strong United Nations Stabilization Mission in the Central African country, known as MONUSCO, has long lost the trust of the local population. It signed a withdrawal agreement at the end of November. The mandate of the Seven-Nation East African Community Regional Force, which deployed troops to the violence-plagued region late last year, expired on December 8 on Tshisekedi's request. Well, Tshisekedi's 5 years in office haven't left much in the way of notable achievements. Forced into an awkward power-sharing deal with outgoing President Joseph Kabila, who ruled Congo for 18 years, it took Tshisekedi 2 years to distance himself from the former leader and his political camp. But even in the second half of his term, Tshisekedi hasn't undertaken any significant reforms, probably due to the escalating crisis in the East and the approaching elections. Of securing power with political alliances, Tshisekedi's challenger, Katumbi, has already united several competitors behind him, including former Prime Minister Matata Ponyo. Two other heavyweights remain, Martin Fayulu, who many believe was the real victor of the contested elections in 2018, and Mukwege. Together, these two could join forces to form a second opposition alliance remains to be seen. In the 2018 elections, several prominent opposition leaders were banned from running. In contrast, the 2023 list is crowded. From the outset, Tshisekedi gambled on dispersing the opposition, said Sematumba. That's why CENI admitted all candidates. The more candidates, the better, end quote. Well, the question of alliances is also crucial for political newcomer Tshisekedi. The son of seasoned politician, charismatic opposition figure Etienne Tshisekedi, who essentially began his political career when he assumed the presidency in early 2019. Tshisekedi doesn't know the country, and the country doesn't know him, said Sematumba. In his 5 years in power, I think he's only been to the East once, before the M23 resurgence in October. According to Sematumba, Tshisekedi's party, the Union for Democracy and Social Progress, doesn't have roots in large parts of the country. That's why the president has forged his own alliance with political heavyweights from different regions. Former Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba, who has a strong base in the north, Economy Minister Vital Kamerhe, and others from North Kivu, and his Prime Minister Sama Lukunde of Katanga Province in the southeast. Well, the election will also have an element of surprise. It's a first past the post ballot, which means there will be no runoff between the top two candidates. As a result, a slight lead could be enough to secure the presidency. So we'll have to see where that goes. One second. With regard to the Israel-Hamas war, the World Health Organization is calling for the Gaza hospital to be spared. The World Health Organization says that less than a third of Gaza's hospitals are now functioning. Meanwhile, the United Nations General Assembly is set to hold a vote on a humanitarian ceasefire, and this is the latest stuff. The World Health Organization is appealing for 11 hospitals still partially functioning in Gaza to be spared. Israel announces the opening of the Nitzana and Kerem Shalom crossings to examine aid for Gaza. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says that Israel will not remain in Gaza permanently. And the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, says that the bloc sanctioned violent Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Well, the White House is going to speak with Netanyahu about the Gaza war timetable. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said he will speak with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about a timetable for ending major combat in Gaza when he visits Israel this week. The subject of how they are seeing the timetable of the war, of this war, will certainly be on the agenda for my meetings, Sullivan said at a forum hosted by the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday. Well, Sullivan spoke of a potential shift away from the current large-scale ground offensive and airstrikes in Gaza. Quote, it doesn't have to be that you go from that to literally nothing in terms of putting pressure on going after Hamas targets, Hamas leadership, or continuing to have tools in your toolbox to try to secure the release of hostages, he said.
It just means that you move to a different phase from the kind of high-intensity operations that we see today. Netanyahu has previously stated that the Israeli Defense Forces would maintain open-ended security control over Gaza once the conflict is over. Quote, I will have the opportunity to talk to Prime Minister Netanyahu about what exactly he has in mind with that comment, because that can be interpreted in a number of different ways, Sullivan had said. Sullivan said that the Biden administration does not want to see Israel reoccupy Gaza to shrink its territory. The U.S. government has also called for the return of the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority in Gaza. Sullivan added that, quote, the U.S. position on this is clear. Bear with me a moment here. I need to find one other article. Bear with me a second. One moment here. Well, the Israeli soldiers have reportedly raided a Gaza hospital. The health ministry in the Hamas-run Gaza Strip has said that Israeli forces are raiding a hospital in the north of the Palestinian territory. Israeli occupation forces are storming Kamal Adwan Hospital after besieging and bombing it for days, ministry spokesman Ashraf Al-Hudra said in a statement. Al-Hudra said that the troops were rounding up men in the hospital courtyard, including medical staff. Israel's military did not immediately comment on the report. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said that two mothers were killed when the maternity department of the hospital was reportedly hit on Monday. While the hospital remains surrounded by Israeli troops and tanks, and fighting with armed groups has been reported in its vicinity for three consecutive days, OCHA said. Well, health services in Gaza have been devastated, with only 11 of Gaza's 36 hospitals functioning at any capacity, according to the World Health Organization. And one second. All right, let me find something else. Yes, here it is. Houthis are claiming responsibility for a Norwegian tanker strike. Houthi rebels in Yemen today claimed responsibility for an attack on a Norwegian commercial tanker by the name of Strinda, S-T-R-I-N-D-A. The Iranian-backed rebels targeted the tanker with a rocket after the crew refused to respond to all warnings, said Yahya Sari, a Houthi military spokesperson. The assault on the oil and chemical tanker expands a campaign by the group targeting ships close to the Bab el-Mandeb Straits. Well, Sari said that the Houthis would continue blocking all ships heading to Israeli ports until Israel allows the entry of food and medical aid into the Gaza Strip. Quote, all crew members are unhurt and safe, said Gail Bulsenes, Belsnes, the CEO of the Sindra's operator, J. Ludwig Movinkels-Lederi. The vessel is now proceeding to a safe port. The Houthis have carried out a series of attacks on vessels in the Red Sea and also launched drones and missiles targeting Israel. And one second here. A big question has always been, can Hamas really be completely eliminated? So the Israeli government has been clear. The militant Islamist group Hamas will be eliminated, quote unquote, many senior members of government, including the country's prime minister, have all said. On certain Israeli television channels, slogans such as Together We Will Win appear regularly, but is it really possible to completely eliminate Hamas and, quote, win, end quote, in a situation like this? The short answer, as experts have reportedly said, is no. So that's the whole issue. Israel has been bombing the Gaza Strip
home to more than about 2 million Palestinians since the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas, which is classified as a terrorist organization by Germany, the European Union, the U.S., and others. And Israel has launched a ground offensive into the Gaza Strip and is blocking the delivery of food, water, and power into the enclave. Now, despite this, most analysts say it won't be possible to get rid of Hamas altogether, the main reason being that Hamas is more than just a militant organization. Hamas has an estimated 20,000 to 30,000 fighters, Guido Steinberg, an expert on the Middle East at the German Institute for International Security Affairs, advised recently. But he added, quote, "It is also a social movement with mass support in the Gaza Strip, and that is a problem in the long run." Hamas has been in de facto control of the Gaza Strip since 2007, and as part of its social movement, there is a welfare network known as Dawa. And this civilian network is thought to have between 80,000 and 90,000 members, Steinberg had said. Dawa means call or invitation, and is historically defined as a way of calling or inviting more believers to one's faith through social outreach, the Oxford Dictionary of Islam explains. Well, Israel, quote, would love to eradicate Hamas as an institution, as a political, religious, and cultural structure, and as a military structure. Rashid Khalidi, a professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, New York, told the Spanish newspaper El País in late October. "I don't think they can do the first two things, he argued. Whether they kill all their leaders, whether they kill all the armed militants, Hamas will remain as a political force, whether the Israelis occupy Gaza or leave. So destroying Hamas as a political institution, destroying Hamas as an idea is impossible. Hamas does not recognize the state of Israel. The group believes that religion should be the basis of any Palestinian government, but it is probably its self-described position as a resistance movement opposed to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in the Gaza Strip that makes it most popular." However, Khalidi added that the Israelis may well be able to do is degrade Hamas's military capabilities, but only to a limited extent and period. Well, destroying Hamas's military potential. Israel has one of the most powerful militaries in the world, ranking 18th out of 145 nations in the 2023 On Global Firepower's annual list of armed strength. For comparison, Germany sits in the 25th place. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reports that last year Israel spent 4.5% of its national income on defense. That's more than the United States or Germany, which spent 3.5% and 1.4% respectively. Meanwhile, Hamas's military wing operates more like a guerrilla group and has smuggled most of its weapons into the Gaza Strip. So Israel certainly has the resources to degrade Hamas and hunt down its leaders. Although the numbers cannot be independently verified, the Israeli government said recently it believes it has killed between 5,000 and 7,000 of Hamas fighters. If this could be seen as a partial success, because weakening Hamas may well be the best that can be expected. Some Western officials believe that the Israeli offensive to date, combined with upgraded border security, has made sure that Hamas will not launch another attack like that of October 7, experts at the think tank International Crisis Group wrote last week. As Hamas did after conflicts with Israel in 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, the group will almost certainly rearm and restore. Dennis Ross, a former U.S. envoy to the Middle East, wrote in an op-ed for the New York Times in late October. That is why, he explained, he was against a ceasefire until Hamas had been removed from power. It's very hard to defeat guerrilla groups. At the same time, very few national militaries have managed to decisively defeat guerrilla groups in the past. Unsuccessful examples include the U.S. effort against the Taliban in Afghanistan and insurgent groups in Iraq, the Sri Lankan government's defeat of the separatist rebel group Tamil Tigers in the nation's civil war is often cited as a case where a national army did win. But as is also often pointed out, that victory took 26 years of war, a death toll of between 80 to 100,000 people, and potential war crimes committed by both sides. In fact, in some situations where an insurgent group's capabilities were degraded, but it managed to survive, the group reemerged later in a more extremist form. A common example is the brutal Islamic State group, which evolved out of the remnants of Al-Qaeda. Israel itself has never managed to defeat Hamas conclusively, despite assassinating a number of its leaders, including two founders of the group. So how to kill an idea? The Israeli military can do the best job they can. They could eliminate the leadership. They can destroy missile launching facilities. Justin Crump, a terrorism expert who heads Sibylline Limited, a global intelligence and risk analysis consultancy, said, quote, "But they won't eliminate the idea of Hamas. Destroying Hamas by military means makes no sense," Crump told Deutsche Welle, "because while some Gazans are turning against Hamas, other people in Gaza sympathize with Hamas. They will resent Israel for these actions, and that is going to fuel the cycle of violence as it always has done, unless there is a very big change at the end of this," end quote. So further, after more than 2 months of intense Israeli operations, it is evident that eradicating Hamas, even as a fighting force, will be a tall order, and the push to do so will destroy what is left of Gaza. A policy briefing by the think tank International Crisis Group, or ICS, published on December 9, concluded. According to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry, over 18,000 people have been killed by Israel and over 49,500 injured in just 2 months. An estimated 61% of those killed are civilians, according to an analysis by Yagil Levy, a sociology professor at the Open University of Israel and cited by Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which means the nation in Hebrew. So over half of all of Gaza's buildings have been destroyed, and 90% of the population is now displaced. Quote, Netanyahu claims that Hamas's destruction will enable the de-radicalization of Gaza, but the opposite is likely, ICS expert wrote. The campaign underway and its aftermath will produce new, perhaps still more tenacious forms of militancy. Just want to check on this one thing here. So let's look at who some of the Hamas leaders are. Israel has said that one of the aims of its military operation in Gaza is to get rid of Hamas's leaders. But who are they? Yahya Sinwar is thought to be the mastermind behind the terrorist attacks on October 7th of 2023. When countless fighters of the militant group Hamas crossed the border from the Gaza Strip into Israel, killing more than 1,200 people and abducting around 240 people. The most senior Hamas leader in the Gaza Strip is currently one of Israel's most wanted men. The Israeli army has vowed to eliminate him and crush the group, of which he is but one of several top commanders. The butcher of Khan Yunis, Yahya Sinwar, considered charismatic and highly intelligent, as well as brutal and ruthless, Yahya Sinwar rules with an iron fist. He was born in the refugee camp of Khan Yunis in the south of the Gaza Strip in 1962 and was one of the early members of Hamas when it was formed in 1987. A few years later, he was also involved in setting up its military wing, the Hassan Brigades, which has carried out suicide attacks in Israel. He was nicknamed the Butcher of Khan Yunis after taking brutal action against Palestinians suspected of collaborating with Israel. In 1988, an Israeli court sentenced him to 4 life sentences after he was convicted of killing two Israeli soldiers and murdering several Palestinians. Sinwar learned Hebrew in jail and reportedly studied the mindset of the quote-unquote by reading books by famous Israeli personalities. Israel doctors have said are said to have saved his life from an abscess which was removed from near his brain. In 2011, Sinwar was released after 22 years in jail, alongside more than 1,000 Palestinians as part of a prisoner exchange deal that led to Hamas freeing the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Sinwar returned to Gaza and became responsible for liaising between the military and political arms of Hamas. In 2017, he became the group's leader in the Gaza Strip. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently accused Sinwar of deliberately sacrificing Palestinian civilians in the fight against Israel. Cat with Nine Lives, Mohammed Daif. Mohammed Daif has led Hamas's military wing, the Qassam Brigade, since 2002. Israel has said he is responsible for several suicide attacks and the death of dozens of Israeli soldiers and civilians. Daif is also thought to be one of those behind the extensive Hamas tunnel system in Gaza, and he too is accused of having planned and led the October 7 attacks. The Israeli army has said it wants to kill him during its ongoing military operations. Daif has been one of Israel's most wanted men since 1995. He was temporarily imprisoned in Israel in 2000, but was able to escape during the turmoil of the Second Intifada, an armed Palestinian uprising that lasted from 2000 to 2005, and there has hardly been a trace of him since. He is thought to have survived 7 assassination attempts, which left him seriously injured and killed several members of his family. Daif is said to have lost an eye, a foot, and part of his arm. He never appears in public and is rumored that he spends each night in a different building. Well, the deputy commander-in-chief of the Qassam Brigade, Marwan Issa. Marwan Issa was also born in a refugee camp in Gaza. Little is known about his youth, but he is said to have belonged to the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, the organization from which Hamas later emerged. Issa served in case you are not familiar with the name, Issa is Jesus. So Issa means that in Arabic, served a 5-year prison sentence in Israel during the First Intifada, 1987 to 1993. In 1997, he was arrested and jailed by the Palestinian Authority, but he was released after the Second Intifada began in 2000. Today, he is the deputy commander-in-chief of the Qassam Brigades and Daif's right-hand man. Well, Issa has also survived several targeted assassination attempts by Israel and remains high on the state's wanted list. Well, the Hamas leaders in Qatar, Ismail Haniyeh and Khaled Masal. Since two of its most important leaders are not in Gaza, but in the Gulf Emirate of Qatar, it would be difficult for Israel to completely extinguish Hamas. Ismail Haniyeh, who is generally considered to be the organization's supreme leader, was also born in a Gaza refugee camp. Haniyeh attended a United Nations school and went on to study at the Islamic University of Gaza, where he reportedly first came into contact with Palestinian independence movements. He was appointed dean of the philosophy department in 1993, and in 1997, he became the personal secretary of Hamas founder Ahmed Yassin. Haniyeh was appointed Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority by President Mahmoud Abbas after Hamas won a majority of seats in the 2006 legislative elections. However, he was dismissed just 1 year later after Hamas unleashed a wave of violence to oust Abbas's Fatah party from the Gaza Strip. Haniyeh refused to step down, and Hamas continued to rule the Gaza Strip while Fatah remained responsible for the occupied West Bank. In 2017, Haniyeh was elected head of the Hamas Political Bureau, succeeding Khaled Masal. Masal was born in the West Bank in 1956 and studied physics at the Kuwait University. He later lived in Syria and Jordan and was also a founding member of the Hamas Political Bureau, becoming its chairman in 1996. He called for terror attacks against Israel and survived a 1997 assassination attempt by Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency. In 2012, he traveled to Gaza via Egypt to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the founding of Hamas. It was reportedly the first time he had set foot on Palestinian territory in 45 years. In 2017, he stepped down as Hamas's leader to make way for Haniyeh. He is now head of the organization's political bureau. So that is the story. That is the end of our time. So we'll just have to see how all of this goes. There's just so much happening all over the world. It's just absolutely amazing. In Ethiopia, a deadly famine is ravaging the Tigray region. Donald Tusk, the pro-European Union coalition, is set to take power in Poland. So that's come about. And I guess that's about it. All right, so tomorrow is another day, and we'll be able to try to cover stuff on that. Congratulations to Javier Milei, who is sworn in as the new Argentine president. We'll talk more about him tomorrow. So just all the best. Not to necessarily want to move from the Middle East, but we certainly want to focus in on Argentina because the promise of his presidency is great and grand, and we can only wish that Argentina will eclipse its many decades of dysfunction from an economic point of perspective. So let's hope for that. I actually just crossed the border from Brazil to Argentina, but that's it, just on the border. I don't know, I'm getting physically better. I haven't traveled by plane anywhere, but to be honest with you, one of the places I'd like to go back to is South America, and I would like to spend more time in Argentina. I also have relatives who live in Cordoba, and since I'd gotten sick, I wasn't able to go visit them. That goes back a long, 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 long time. In fact, interestingly enough, my first cardiologist knew my father's parents through his parents, and we're somehow related, of all things. And the connection is from Poland all the way to Chile, and I met him at Mount Sinai Hospital. Go figure. The world is really smaller than we think. Anyway, all the best. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.